Hi, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for subscribing to the Counter Stories podcast. We usually only post our conversations with the regular Counter Stories team here, but today, a bonus episode. This is an interview I had with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, who first asked this question 20 years ago. Why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? That's the name of the book she wrote in the 90s. It's now been updated and re-released. Tatum is a psychologist, former president of Spelman College, and she was in town in the Twin Cities this month for a conference and came by the studio. So many of the issues we discussed come up in Counter Stories, thus the desire to post this here, including why she even wanted to update the book after two decades.
In my role as a college president, I had had the opportunity to travel to other college campuses, speak to lots of students, and I was thinking a lot about the question, why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria, and how it might be answered by somebody born in 1997, the year I wrote my book originally. 20 years later, that young person has experienced some things very different from previous generations. If you were born in 1997, you were 4 years old when 9/11 happened, and your life experience certainly colored by that narrative in the United States. If you were born in 1997, you were 11 in 2008 when the economy crashed and what that meant for your family. You were 11 when President Barack Obama was elected. And what did that mean in terms of all the conversation about a so-called post-racial society, the narrative that took place after that election? You were 15 when Trayvon Martin was killed. And what did that mean for you in terms of how you thought about your own coming of age? And of course, how you think about that would depend on whether you identified with Trayvon Martin or maybe with the person who shot him. And then you're 17 when Ferguson happens, Michael Brown's death and the Ferguson uprisings and campus unrest. 19 when our current president, Donald Trump, was elected. And maybe 20 when Charlottesville happened. Certainly Charlottesville happened after the release of my book, but All of those events leading up to our current state are the things that I've tried to reflect on in this last 20 years.
And so I get why there's a lot of differences and updates in that regard, but the themes don't seem very different.
And the themes are not very different. And that is one of the reasons why the book, even though there's a lot of new content, has the same title. Because, in fact, our demographics have changed a lot. I often talk about the new faces of America. Our population is much more diverse today than it was even 20 years ago. But the same places, same residential segregation, even more school segregation than we had 20 years ago. So the social dynamic that was informing some of what I had to write 20 years ago is certainly still in place.
To that point about the segregation, especially in schools, that a part of which we can tie to the self-segregation in neighborhoods, right? Because we want to go to the schools closest to us. And so there's this concept of self-segregation.
Well, I don't use that term self-segregation, though, of course, it could be used and we'd have to define what you mean by it.
I used it because I think the Supreme Court has said things like that before in talking about whether segregation in some cases...
Well, I think if we... Sure. Well, certainly it is difficult to address school segregation without addressing residential segregation.
Right.
But what I responded to when I heard you use the phrase self-segregation was the idea that segregation is perhaps a matter of choice. And for certainly populations of color, it has not historically been a matter of choice. So that if we look at the way in which neighborhoods are constructed, a lot of that has to do with policies and practices which have shaped them, like, for example, even if we go back several generations to World War II and the GI Bill and how it was administered when vets were coming back and looking to start families and buy houses, and those loans being awarded particularly for purchase in new construction, suburban communities, some of which had racial covenants that prevented black families or other families of color moving into them. We can look at redlining done by the federal agencies, FHA and others, in terms of who could get loans and where they could purchase homes. You can look at also real estate steering and all of the policies and practices from the 50s, you know, the middle of the 20th century, that really helped shape where neighborhoods are today and who lives in them.
But does that then also explain the increase in segregation in the 20 years since your book first came out?
No, what helps explain that are the Supreme Court decisions. So let's talk for a moment about that. Brown versus Board of Education, of course, we all know that's the landmark decision, 1954, declaring separate as unequal and requiring states to begin to desegregate. What we know is that that was a slow process. The process began to speed up when Lyndon Johnson, during his presidency, threatened the removal of funding from the Department of Education for those states that did not comply with court-ordered segregation. So you saw a pattern of school desegregation fairly rapid in southern states, but in those places where school segregation was not by law, but more de facto segregation, in the north, northeast, for example, very little movement in that regard. And in those places where, for example, I grew up in Massachusetts, in Boston, where there was court-ordered school desegregation, you started to see white flight out of those districts to avoid the school desegregation process. So that was part of, you know, the climate in the 70s and 80s. But when President Nixon became president, one of the things that he had the opportunity to do was to make four Supreme Court appointments. And we now know, history tells us, that he considered whether those judges were in favor or in opposition to busing as a criteria for making his selection. So he appointed people who were opposed to school busing, and not surprisingly, they ruled in favor of school districts that were trying to avoid the use of busing. One of those cases was Milliken in Detroit. If you've got a city like Detroit with a large black population, very difficult to desegregate those schools unless you can bus across district lines, bringing in suburban kids. The court ruled you could not force busing across district lines. That made it certainly difficult for cities positioned in that way to desegregate. More recently, you can look at, I guess it was 2007, decision which had to do with whether you can use race in making school assignments if you're using, let's say, magnet schools. So a lot of districts, in their effort to desegregate, would create special schools with special programs that would draw people in from across the city into a particular school, using it as a magnet, right? But if you are using those programs and want to determine a diverse student population, typically what schools would do would be to count, right? We've got X number of black kids, X number of Latinos, X number of white kids. And some white parents brought suit in Seattle to say, you know, I wanted my kid to go there. She's been discriminated against because she's white. I think that's wrong. And then the court ruled that you couldn't take race into consideration in K through 12 school placements, making it very difficult to achieve the kind of diversity you might want across racial lines. So as a result of a variety of court decisions, and I've just lifted up a couple of them, what you see today is that school districts are relying on essentially neighborhood school assignments. And that brings us back to neighborhood segregation. If the neighborhoods are segregated, the schools are going to be.
But so you just spoke there for about 2 minutes or so to explain that, maybe a little more. The conversation's much easier to have to just say, okay, I get it that schools are more segregated now than they used to be. But that's just because the neighborhoods are segregated too, and there's nothing we can do about that, right? I mean, that's the narrative, right?
That is the narrative. And it is a challenge. So, you know, there would be those who would say, if you, as a parent, want to have your child in a racially diverse school, you're either going to have to live in a racially diverse neighborhood, or you're going to have to find a school that is diverse and drive your kid there because the local school district is not going to be providing the transportation. Some parents will make that choice. There was an interesting study recently done by Phi Delta Kappan, which is an education honor society. They have a publication called Kappan, and they do an annual survey of attitudes toward public education. And in this particular survey, one of the things that they found was that many parents of varying racial backgrounds agree that sending your child to a diverse school is a good thing. However, they also asked, would you be willing to travel to get your child to such a school? And a very small percentage, something like 25%, said,
it's worth the trip.
It's worth the trip.
Yeah,
Most people said, not. I wrote an essay about it.
In the LA Times here.
Yeah.
70% of people would like to have their child in a racially diverse school, but 57% prefer proximity over diversity. Just 25% find diversity worth the trip.
Exactly.
As you note there. We're talking here with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, who wrote the book originally 20 years ago, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria?, recently re-released with updates to address and add in a bunch of stuff that's happened in the past 20 years. But you're a psychologist as well, and you actually, the title of the book isn't just a cute title. I mean, you get into the question. So why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? It's really interesting to hear the psychological and reasons around adolescence, too, as to why that actually is.
Exactly. So I do talk about it from a developmental perspective. And if we are talking about racially mixed schools, if you walk into an elementary school, you're likely to not see the black kids sitting together because children are much more likely to be connecting across racial lines in first, second, third grade. The kind of separation that we talk about in the cafeteria is pretty much associated with puberty, meaning that as children are approaching adolescence, they start to think in a more adult way about what their own identities are and what it means to be a young person of color, a young black person, a young Latinx person, a young Asian American person. Their ideas about that are shaped by the feedback they're getting in the environment. You know, how you respond to a young 6-year-old African-American boy, for example, is very different than how you respond to a tall 14-year-old mm-hmm. African-American boy. And that child, as he gets older or as she gets older, starts to pay attention to that feedback and starts to think about, what does this mean for who I am? And seeking out peers who are having similar experiences, asking similar questions, is a very common experience. There's a way in which connecting with peers who are having a similar experience to your own serves as a buffer, as a protective mm-hmm. force, but it also is a way of affirming your identity.
I'm going to sit with my fellow black students in the cafeteria because they're going through some of the same things that the white students, they just wouldn't understand. They just don't get it. And that's a bonding experience.
Exactly. But I want to say that if the white kids did get it, they might be able to sit together. And I want to use an example.
Yeah.
So let's imagine, and this is actually an example from the book. I talk about a young black girl going to a racially mixed school. She is being bused into that school. And often when kids are in that busing situation, it's hard for them to do things after school because
right.
of transportation. So a well-intentioned white teacher is talking to her about staying after school for a school social event, a school dance. And she's saying she's not going to go to the dance, and he's trying to encourage her because he wants more of the kids to participate. Again, very well-intentioned. But she keeps saying, no, she's not going. And finally he says, oh, come on, I know you people love to dance.
You people.
All of that language is loaded. We can hear that he's drawing upon a stereotype, and he's using that you people language, and she's offended. And you can understand why she might be. But let's imagine the same eighth grade girl is walking down the hall, now upset with this teacher, and she runs into a white friend who asks her why she appears to be upset. She explains what Mr. Smith, I'm going to call him, has mm-hmm. just said. And that white friend, in an effort to be comforting, might say something like, oh, come on, you're being oversensitive. Mr. Smith didn't mean it. Now she's put her foot in it, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
Because when you're upset, what you want is somebody to listen to you, to understand your experience. You don't want them to minimize it, to say, oh, you know, come on, he didn't really mean it. Even though she might be exactly right about Mr. Smith and his motivation. The point is that the girl, the black girl who's been offended, is now feeling like, not only am I mad at Mr. Smith, but my friend here doesn't get where I'm coming from. Let's imagine she runs into another student. This time it's another black girl. And she tells that girl what has happened. That black girl might say to her, you know what? Mr. Smith said the same thing to me yesterday. Mm-hmm. The two of them are going off now with a shared experience.
Yeah.
But you can imagine that if that white friend had responded differently, let's imagine the white friend said something like, I can't believe he used that language.
Yeah.
You know, now the two of them are talking about Mr. Smith sitting together at the cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
But at least they're connecting because that black girl is feeling more understood by her friend.
So it's intriguing when you talk about it in the developmental sense,
mm-hmm.
because it is so stark to see the preschool room
mm-hmm.
where all the kids are playing together of all colors. And then by high school, they are sitting together or they are sitting with other black kids and other white kids at the cafeteria. If you explain it from a psychological standpoint, as you do in the book, and talk about how this works into the development of adolescence,
mm-hmm.
does that excuse it?
Well, what I like to say when I, you know, the reason that book is titled the way it is that when I was visiting schools and doing workshops with teachers and principals, they would often start the conversation by asking me this very question. Why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? And often in a tone that would suggest, and what can we do to prevent it?
Yeah.
Right?
Prevent it.
Prevent it. Like it's a problem. We're concerned that the kids are all sitting together in the cafeteria. And what I like to say about that is our concern should be less about what kids are doing in their free time at lunch and what's happening in the classroom. In schools, and sometimes I will meet young people who will tell me, well, that's not how the cafeteria looks in my school. And when you probe that, you will often find that they're in a school where there have been some very intentional practices around what I call the ABCs, affirming identity, building community, and cultivating leadership. A, affirming identity means that schools have been very intentional about creating spaces or ways in which they affirm the identities of all of the students so that nobody's feeling marginalized in that environment, but everybody's feeling welcomed and included. And there's some very specific things that schools can do to create that kind of environment. And B, building community is really about ways in which schools can be very intentional in recognizing the diversity in the community and, because they're affirming mm-hmm. the identities of all the members, bringing people together in ways where everybody feels part of the picture. For your listeners, I want to create an image. Let's imagine that a photographer was taking a group photo of everyone in the school, and everybody got a copy of that picture. The first thing that any person who gets a group photo is going to do is look for themselves
right.
in the picture.
Yeah.
There's no other.
You don't have to be a teenager to do that. Anyone.
No, anyone. We all look for ourselves in the picture. So let's imagine a group photo's been taken, except this time, before you got your copy, you were digitally removed from the picture. You're looking for yourself in that environment. You know you should be in that photo, but you don't see yourself anywhere. There are schools where kids walk in and they don't see themselves anywhere in the picture. They don't see themselves in the curriculum. They don't see themselves among the teachers. They don't see themselves included in the clubs. And if you are not affirmed by being included in the photo, then you don't necessarily want to be an active part of the community. So the A, what we do to affirm identity, is a necessary component of the B, building community. And the C, cultivating leadership, is recognizing that because kids are growing up in different neighborhoods, because they don't have the daily experience of interacting with people who look different from themselves often, that we have to be intentional in helping young people connect across lines of difference. And you can go to schools where the leadership is doing that, where they're affirming identity, they're building community, and they're helping kids develop the skills for connecting across lines of difference. And in those schools, you are less likely to see that kind of separation in the cafeteria.
How much of what you're talking about, though, the need to have more conversations? I mean, you make the point, by the way, that these are conversations that we grow up learning
yes.
that are best to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, your point is stop it. Like, start talking about it. And I can't tell you, Beverly, how many tweets I get when we have conversations about race. I'm sure I'll get one about this. Who tweet at me and say, you're making it worse.
Yes.
By having this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to respond to their tweet. I don't need an answer here today because I kind of ignore it because I don't get
people
with it.
Tell that to me. I mean, people come to my talk sometimes and they'll say, I think you're making it worse by talking about it. You know, you say that we should be talking about it, but aren't you just reinforcing the idea that race is a real thing and not a social construct? You know, these categories that we use to describe each other are really artificial, and they are, and yet they have real meaning in people's daily lives. You know, it's one thing to say it's an artificial construct. It's another thing to say, you know, and black men are more likely to be shot. You know, that's a real...
Which is a fact.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
And so... Having said that, it is important, I think, to have the conversations. But people will say that too much talk, you know, just makes people feel uncomfortable. And I write about why people do feel so uncomfortable. But I like to say conversations about race are kind of like antibiotics. They only work unless you take the whole course.
Oh, that's it? You can't stop after two pills? Is
right.
that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. That the fact of the matter is that if we have, you know, a workshop in an afternoon or we go to a conversation at the local civic center.
You do the one brown bag during work or at school.
That typically is enough to make people feel uncomfortable, but not enough to get past the levels of understanding we need to make real change.
How much of the need, though, to have the cross-racial communications is really, in your opinion, about white people needing to learn more about their position in society and, well, just to use the vernacular, to become more woke? How much of this is about teaching white people to become woke versus black people needing to learn something?
Well, we all have things to learn. You know, I taught my course on the psychology of racism for many, many years, 20 years before I became a college administrator and, you know, eventually a college president. And one of the things that I would say to my students is that we all have something to learn. We all get misinformation about people different from ourselves. We also get misinformation about people like ourselves. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that we've all been exposed to what I call the smog of racial stereotyping, the smog of misinformation, to the extent that we've all been exposed to that, we all have work to do in terms of re-educating ourselves. That said, it is often the case that people who are in the targeted group know more mm-hmm. about the dominant group than people in the dominant group know about the people who've been targeted. So in this that sense, there are different things to learn. One of the statistics I quote in the book is a survey done by PRRI, which says something like 75% of white people are in social networks that are entirely white, meaning have no interaction with people of color at all, not in their neighborhoods, not in their workplaces, not in their schools. And as a consequence, it's difficult to understand somebody else's experience if you're never engaging with someone who's having it, right? But I do think that it is important to say that there's work for all of us to do. And so I don't give people of color a pass in that regard. You know, we all have internalized some negative information, and we all in our own way sometimes reinforce the cycle of racism in our society. We can all work to interrupt it. We have different work to do sometimes, but we all have work to do.
Beverly Daniel Tatum with me, author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? First came out 20 years ago. There's a re-release this year with a lot of updates. One of the updates, Beverly, is in the last 20 years, demographically speaking, there has been a baby boom in the world of biracial children, biracial babies, and multiracial kids. And so identity around being biracial, I sense, is a thing you had to write more about for this book than when you wrote the book originally.
Absolutely. And I happen to know that Minnesota is a place where there's a relatively high percentage of multiracial families. It's one of the largest populations in the nation. One of the things that was quite striking to me as I was working on the update of my book is just how much more research has been done by social scientists about identity development among young people who come from multiracial families, mm-hmm. both in terms of multiracial families that are defined by one white parent and one parent of color, or in some cases, white families that have adopted children of color. You can create multiracial families in lots of different ways.
A lot of adoption, Korean adoption here in Minnesota, for example, as one example.
Yes. And so I think that there's a lot of very useful information in the book, particularly for parents who are thinking about how to help their child, either adopted or biracial child, to develop a positive sense of identity in the context in which they may be living, often a community where they don't see very many other children like themselves and yet are trying to figure out what their place is in that community.
So does the next version of the book become why are all the biracial kids sitting together in the cafeteria? Or have you found in research that actually there's a different dynamic going on there with both biracial and multiracial kids?
Well, there is a different dynamic in this sense. There are a lot of factors that influence how young people of color who identify as biracial or multiracial choose to identify. Some of those factors might be what they look like. I'm going to use probably the most famous biracial person we can think of, and that's Barack Obama, right? Who, raised by his white mother and his white grandparents, nonetheless, in his adolescence, was very intentional in crafting a black identity for himself, in part because when people saw him, that's how they viewed him.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of his physical appearance, people didn't say, oh, are you biracial? They just assumed he was African American, and that was a major factor in how he came to identify himself. On the other hand, there are some biracial youth whose physical appearance is more racially ambiguous. People are always asking them, what are you?
Oh, that's the worst question you can ask, by the way.
It is a very offensive question. I'm a human being. That's what I am.
I'm in America. I'm a human being.
But people are often trying to place them in a racial category. And for those young people, they may make a different choice. They may choose to describe themselves and claim a biracial identity or a multiracial identity. I have read, and this was an interesting shift in terms of what happens typically in the United States. You know, we have had for a long time what is called the one-drop rule, which is if you had any African ancestry, people automatically categorized you as black. And the option to call yourself white seemed to be not a political or a demographic choice. But in recent research around multiracial identity, there are some young people whose physical appearance is more white-like, European-American is how they're perceived, and who are claiming a white identity for themselves, not because they are, quote, trying to pass or reject the parent of color, but because that's how people view them and that's how they're responded to, and that's the identity that they're claiming.
I know that we don't have time to go into this, but there's a whole other conversation to be had, and maybe you'll be doing some research about this, about all of these new websites that offer your DNA test to tell you where, quote unquote, where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they're not super accurate right now, unless you're 100% European, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just from how the science works and how many. Mm-hmm. But I've talked to some people who get very emotional about this and say this is a very bad thing to be happening, to have all these websites out there to proclaim, to say you're 10% this and 10% that, A, because they're wrong, but B, because it just falsifies and fakeifies, or whatever the word is, your own identity journey. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do have some thoughts on it in the sense that, you know, that data that you get from those various companies that will send you, you know, your DNA analysis doesn't change what your lived experience has
exactly
been. And so to the extent, you know, we've all seen the commercial of the person who learns that they're Native American and now wants to explore that,
and then there's all the scenery of the Native artifacts.
Yes, like, exactly.
It's so forced.
Well, and it doesn't speak to that person's lived experience. You know, I think that you know, if someone who had lived as a white person all their lives and then did their DNA analysis and found out that they had African ancestors, which is entirely possible because we know about the history of passing as white, for example, someone might not know that they had African American ancestors. And then to say, well, you know, I have this black identity and yet not have lived an experience, or, you know, I would wonder about how that really shaped their view of the world. But it's an interesting topic to research, as you said.
I think we'll have to get into it more. Final question for you. What are your thoughts on all the critiques and criticisms about the general topic of identity politics that, especially, you know, I'm not going to go over the 2016 election anymore, but the idea that if you want to get the black vote or the Latino vote, et cetera, that you're playing this racial and identity politics game that serves no one. What do you reflect upon even that phrase, identity politics?
Well, I think the phrase needs unpacking. I think the phrase definitely needs unpacking. I write about racial identity development, and when I write about it, I'm talking about what it means to recognize your identity as defined in a race-conscious society. I think we can agree that we still live in a race-conscious society, and to that extent, we all have a racial identity. When I hear people talk about identity politics in the way that you just asked about it, I think it is often done in a way that is intended to disregard the way in which racism is still alive and well in the United States and still impacting people's life experiences, which is not...
It's a way to dismiss racism as a factor.
Exactly. That's how I hear it. And I think that it is important to acknowledge that there are ways in which one's racial group membership impacts their economic opportunities, their educational opportunities, where they're likely to live. And that if we really want to understand how to create a more equitable society, we have to be able to unpack the impact of racism in our society. And you can't do that without talking about it.
And to your point, I mean, the other phrase you use, we're not a colorblind society. We know that. But we are a color silent society. And your point there is we got to talk about it.
You can't solve a problem without talking about it.